As part of our series, In Honor of Abe, it has been my pleasure to interview the authors of a host of different books about Abraham Lincoln. One of them that I was especially excited about is a book called Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War, How the North Used the Telegraph, Railroads, Surveillance Balloons, Ironclads, High-Powered Weapons, and More to Win the Civil War. This is actually a book, I think, intended primarily for young people, part of a series from National Geographic of children's books. But I got to say, I enjoyed this book so much and learned so much from it, and so I'm very pleased to speak with one of its authors, Roger McBride Allen. He wrote this book with his father, Thomas B. Allen. Thomas B. Allen, an author of several different books on military history. Roger McBride Allen, I believe, an author of science fiction novels. And somehow the mix of their various perspectives yields a very rich and fascinating book. And I'm happy for the next few minutes to be able to speak with Roger McBride Allen about this book from National Geographic called Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War. Roger McBride Allen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
Is this the first book that you have co-authored with your father?
Yes, it is, and we had a great time doing it, and neither of us intends it to be the last. We really enjoyed it.
So whose idea was it?
Well, that's sort of a little bit of a Shaggy Dog story. That one of the books Dad had done previously for the National Geographic was George Washington's Spymaster, which had done very well for them, and George Washington was, in fact, basically a spymaster. He ran a lot of the intelligence service during the Revolutionary War. The Geographic said, hey, that did so well, how about Abraham Lincoln's spymaster? The problem was, he wasn't the spymaster. So we tried to find an approach that had about the same feel to it, and the more we looked at Lincoln's approach to technology, about how he used the war, and new weapons and new ways of doing things, we discovered there was a very rich, really big story there, and we went from there. And it was a wonderful opportunity for my father and I to work together.
Very good. I don't happen to have the book right in front of me, although I read it and enjoyed it thoroughly. I want you to recount for our listeners as best you can, and I don't know if you have the book in front of you or not, but I love how the introduction begins as you make what I think is such a fascinating and discerning observation about Abraham Lincoln's generation and technology compared to the generations that had come before him.
Well, as we say, Lincoln was born the last generation of Americans that didn't expect the world to change, that in terms of technology, in terms of the tools you used every day. He would have, his great-great-great-grandfather would have recognized pretty much everything in the cabin and understood how to use it and understood how it worked. Even the gun over the mantelpiece would have been pretty much the same as what Lincoln's remote ancestors had used.
So we're talking about over the course of hundreds of years,
right,
that the technology would have inched along a little bit, but not so much that any of this would have been incomprehensible to those distant ancestors.
And yet, I think a lot of what Lincoln dealt with in his life would have been completely incomprehensible to his father. That in Lincoln's lifetime, what do we get while he's a boy and growing up? The steam engine comes into use, the steam-powered riverboats, the telegraph, the railroad, printing becomes much more efficient and effective, and the written word becomes much more available. And the railroad can bring you new books. They can bring you a newspaper from hundreds of miles away. Lincoln devoured newspapers whenever he could get his hands on them. Communication was suddenly much more possible. Before that time, you lived in a very small village in the far edge of anywhere. A few years later, all of a sudden, you had contact with the outside world.
And it's funny to think about that. I mean, we think now about our world being this world where everything is possible and accessible, and of course it is in ways that were incomprehensible in the 1830s and 1840s, and yet, in a sense, this was the first glimpse that people had of such a world.
Absolutely, and And Lincoln believed in that. The idea of progress, of moving forward, of the things getting better, of advancing, was a very important part of his viewpoint. He actually did a series of lectures on new inventions during a period when he wasn't involved in politics. He looked into basically making a living doing lectures on progress and inventions. He was the first and only president to be issued a patent. During the war, he was literally hands-on testing weapons. He went down to the Navy Yard and pulled the trigger or pulled the lanyard to fire a new weapon. He went out back of the White House and got in some target practice with the inventor of a new rifle. He was very much a believer in technology being able to change things.
And, of course, that's the bedrock of your fascinating book. Interesting to me, actually, I've spoken now to several different biographers of Lincoln, and one of the most interesting, thorny, troubling questions is about Abraham Lincoln's relationship with his own father, a relationship which seems to have become quite distant, and in some respects Abraham Lincoln seems to have been somewhat dismissive, at least in terms of any written record which he leaves behind, that is dismissive of his father in some respects. And as I read your book and hear you talking about Lincoln's high level of engagement with this new technology emerging and the way in which so much of this would have been utterly incomprehensible to his father, one has to wonder if maybe this is one of the crucial elements in why father and son, in a sense, were so distant from one another. In a sense, they were from two different worlds or part of two different lives.
Well, I've been providing tech support to my dad for years, so I can see that one, my co-author. I think that there is something to that. I mean, one of the dangers with Lincoln is that he is such a large personality, such an important person, and there are so many aspects to him that there's a temptation to try and find a key to turn an A lock to open up the door and explain him. But there were so many sides to him. I think you've got hold of something there. But it's dangerous to say, aha, there's the explanation. Certainly his father represented what he rebelled against. And he was stuck on a farm. At one point, his father pulls him out of school and sends him to work at someone else's farm to pay off a debt the father owes. And in other words, he became something less than hired help. He was a work animal that his father loaned out. And a lot of what he was doing as a young man was working to avoid having to do that kind of dreary, repetitive physical labor again. And yes, technology and machines and gadgets that could do you the work for you had a tremendous attraction to it.
We're speaking with Roger McBride Allen, and we are talking about the book he co-authored called Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War, a book which is part of the series of National Geographic children's books. So the heart and soul of your book concerns some of these amazing technologies which ultimately made such a difference in the Union winning the Civil War. And I guess part of the message of your book is that it is not simply that these technologies existed, but the fact that President Lincoln understood them and appreciated them and had the wisdom to insist on their widespread usage. I mean, in a sense, without President Lincoln, we're left with the question of if someone else would have had that foresight to embrace this technology in quite the same way.
I think that in terms of technology in many other ways, I think without Lincoln, it's possible we're not just two countries today, we might be five or six, or that the North and the South would have split off and possibly disintegrated from there for various reasons. It's almost impossible to overstate his importance. In terms of his understanding the technology, one of the interesting things is that I think he understood it so completely and saw what it could do so completely that it was almost as if it didn't need explaining to others. That of course, once you have the telegraph, you use it to run the war. Of course, once you have a railroad, you use it to transport troops. That was automatic and obvious to him, and it simply wasn't to a lot of the commanders he had to deal with. One of the things nobody really came to terms with, really until perhaps the end of the war, was just how tremendously more powerful and deadly the rifles they had were. Right? Prior to that, they had what are called smoothbore guns, and the term rifle means that there's grooves cut into the barrel of the gun and the interior of the barrel of the gun that make the bullet spin. The bullet spinning makes it much more stable, and it's able to shoot further and far more accurately. And the rifles they had, the rifled muskets, were 2 to 3 times as accurate and had about 2 to 3 times the range of what they replaced. And this was just devastating. The number of casualties caused by rifled muskets on both sides, there was something like 90% of the casualties caused in the war, and nobody really ever came to terms with it during the war in terms of finding tactics that could deal with that.
One of the intriguing distinctions that you make in the book is between certain technologies which already existed but which were put to effective use by the North versus certain technologies like, for instance, the ironclad warships that only emerged during the Civil War. Let's start with the first matter and begin with a technology already in place, namely the telegraph. Tell us about when and where the telegraph emerged and how use of it then, in a sense, changed with the Civil War and with Abraham Lincoln's understanding of it.
Well, of course, the telegraph, the basic idea of it had been around for years and years before then. It was, the problem was basically there was a fairly short-range communication system for quite a while. It was 1844 that Morse sent his first big message, what hath God wrought, that's hard to say. And so if you had 20 years or so to develop the telegraph, it literally followed behind the railroads in many ways. The first people to really say, aha, hey, that would be handy for us, were the railroad operators, because it allowed them to coordinate schedules and to find out that there was a train off the track and communicate quickly for their own purposes. And they strung the railroad right-of-ways with telegraph wires. And in the previous war that the United States was in, the Mexican-American War, the War Department did not even have its own telegraph service. The president had to read in the newspaper that the United States had won the war, because the newspapers had the better communications with the front than he did. Lincoln comes along and he says, aha, we can use the telegraph to stay in direct communication with the commanders. And he's actually sitting there sending orders to his commanders from the War Department in Washington, D.C. And he's running the war in real time. And to be a little facetious, he's sending instant messages to his commanders.
Well, certainly instant messages compared to anything that had been known before, and of course which made such a difference. You really give us some quite a vivid picture of Abraham Lincoln as a very, very frequent visitor to the War Department's telegraph office. I mean, he was there all the time, and that fact alone indicates how much he understood the importance of this and of how it would enable him to be, in a sense, the first commander-in-chief, in fact.
Yes, absolutely. Without the telegraph, he could not have done that. One of the interesting, actually, side effects of all this, which is a treasure trove of information, absolutely fascinating, is that because all the commanders were selling not just Lincoln to his commanders, but all the commanders back and forth and so on, were sending messages via telegraph and so forth, the paper copies of those were a tremendously important historical record, which we still have. There's, I forget, something like 57 volumes, which is basically the entire war on paper, what's called the official records of the Army and Navy. And it's the, and these are available online, and you can read the war. It's a tremendously important historical source that came directly from keeping the war on paper because you're doing it by telegraph.
Hmm. So not only did it make a huge difference then and there in how the war was waged, but it also leaves behind a much more detailed record of how that war was fought than in any conflict that came before.
Absolutely. There's no question of that.
Another really interesting way in which information was disseminated, not instantly, of course, but it made an intriguing difference, was the use of hot air balloons for surveillance. This is something I knew absolutely nothing about. And although it's hard to say, I suppose, in some ways, just what kind of a difference it ultimately made, it's yet another way in which the Union seemed to be ahead of the Confederacy in the embracing of technology.
That's absolutely true. And the Confederates hated the balloons. They drove them crazy. That there was this thing sitting in the sky watching them at all times. Every time the Union tried to, or every time the Union side launched or lowered a balloon, the Confederate side would open up on it and try to shoot it down. Somehow or another, they missed every time. No balloons were actually shot down during the war. But you have a guy 2,000 feet in the air watching your every move. It was obviously a tremendous advantage in wartime. And one of the real surprises is that basically the North walks away from using balloons. They really don't use them after about spring of 1863. There weren't any balloons up at Gettysburg. And I think the two big reasons for that was, one, the generals who embraced this newfangled crazy idea of using a floating observation post lost their battles in spite of the surveillance balloons, not because of them, but they were the losing generals were associated with doing sort of oddball things such as the surveillance balloons. And the other thing is the balloonists themselves were sort of, before the war they were showmen. They were doing stunts with the balloons. They were trying to set records. They were flamboyant. They were putting on shows. They were trying to promote themselves. And they just didn't fit into the Army way of doing things.
The technology which is new to the Civil War, which had not ever been seen before, is the ironclad warship. Explain how these were developed. I mean, whose idea was it, and what kind of a breakthrough this represented?
Well, this was tremendously important. There's no question about that. And it was an arms race, and an arms race that was decided by a couple of hours. It's a remarkable story. At the very beginning of the war, before the Virginia had even entered the Confederacy, a bunch of Confederate sympathizers and pro-secessionist guys basically grab the U.S. Navy shipyards at Newport News, Virginia. The Union forces withdraw, burning what they can as they run away. They burn a ship called the USS Merrimack. The Merrimack sinks. That puts out the fires, and everything below the waterline is wet, but it's not destroyed. The Confederates recover the Merrimack and put it in the dry dock, which they've also just captured, and they proceed to cover her with iron, armor, very thick iron armor, several inches thick, and to rebuild her so she's almost entirely a new ship in some ways, although she still has the creaky old engines that the Union was about to throw out, the steam engines, and she becomes the Virginia. And she's going to be able to wipe out anything in her path. And the North gets word of this. It was hard to keep a secret about something that big, and this throws them into a panic. They've kicked around the idea of doing ironclad ships, but no one had really taken it seriously. But suddenly they hear that the Virginia is being built, and there's a rush on to build something, anything as fast as they can. At one point, Lincoln is handed a paper model of the ship that becomes the Monitor. and he holds it in his hand, and he sees the value in it, and he says, like, he sees there's something in it. 8 days later, it's approved for construction. About 4 to 8 days later, it's approved for construction. They build her in about 100 to 120 days. They've got to get, some things don't quite work right the first time. They've got to make some adjustments. She's put underway toward Hampton Roads, which is where the Virginia is being built at the same time. While she's underway, while she's on the high seas toward that point, the Virginia comes out and starts sinking ships. And the Union ships fire at her, and the cannonballs simply bounce off her, and she just sinks whatever she wants to sink. And she basically has to retreat when the tides change, and she goes back for the night. While she's returned for the night, that is when the Monitor arrives, 9 o'clock at night. And the next morning, the Virginia comes out and planning to just finish sinking the Navy. We're got halfway through it. We'll finish in the morning. And there's the Monitor. Hmm. And it was that close. Now, the two ships fight each other to a standstill. Neither can sink the other. Each of them manages to damage the other, but neither, basically, at the end of the day, neither of them has managed to sink the other or defeat the other. Each finds a way to say, oh, the other guy left first, I must have won. Hmm. It was, in essence, a tie. But they prevented the Virginia from breaking the blockade. If the Virginia had broken the blockade and the Confederacy had been able to trade with the outside world, that would have totally changed the outcome of the war.
In a sense, this took away what appeared to be an unbeatable advantage for the South. I mean, this was a great equalizer in a very crucial matter, and given all the other advantages that the Union had, this might have been the single most crucial difference in tipping the war in the direction it went.
Absolutely. The amazing thing is that the Virginia was the most powerful warship in the world for 12 hours.
Interesting. Much more information, photographs, and more to be found in the pages of this really interesting book called Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War. It's from the series of National Geographic children's books. The authors, Thomas B. Allen and his son, my guest today, Roger McBride Allen. Roger McBride Allen, I really enjoyed your book and talking with you about it today on The Morning Show. My thanks to you.
Thanks to you as well. And I just very quickly mentioned the website, MrLincolnsHighTechWar.com. Everything we couldn't fit in the book, there it is.
A partner in the Morning Show's In Honor of Abe series is the Kenosha Civil War Museum. Using technology, life-size dioramas, and interactive exhibits to connect the battlefront and the home front. For more information on the Kenosha Civil War Museum and Lincoln-related events honoring our 16th president, go online to thecivilwarmuseum.org. The Civil War Museum is located in Kenosha's Harbor Park, just north of the Kenosha Public Museum. We're approaching 9 o'clock, and you're listening to WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio.